you're right that the first thing to think about is estimating risk. And what we find again and again is that people underestimate the risk. And that's, of course, a problem. And it's not just underestimating risk. People also underestimate how long projects will take to complete, how much it would cost, right? Underestimating budgets. All these are related to this phenomena of the optimism bias. And so it's really difficult to try to convince people that their estimate is incorrect.
You're listening to the ISF podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve sits down with Tally Sherritt, professor of neuroscience at University College London, to discuss her fascinating research on optimism bias. Tally offers fresh, evidence-based ideas on effective communication for security leaders who seek to present their message to their board and raise cyber awareness within the organization.
So, Tally, thanks very much for dropping by the studio today. Nice to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've written a couple of books about the brain, about optimism, about all of that kind of thing, which today is probably more important than ever, given the sort of situations that we find ourselves in. But for what I'd read, the inspiration for really putting you on that path of investigating and researching that sort of the brain's innate optimism was around 9/11. Is that the case?
So when I was doing my PhD in New York, it was in 2001 when 9/11 just happened, and I was researching how emotion changes memory. Mm-hmm. And specifically traumatic memories. And so we were interested in what goes on in the brain that causes us to feel like we remember these traumatic events with really vividness and detail. So when you think back to events like 9/11, we usually feel like it's kind of a video in our brain that we turn on and we really see the events, right? But it turns out that that's just a feeling. It's not necessarily more accurate, those memories. It just feels more accurate. Right. So we were studying how this happens in the brain, and we were identifying a circuit in the brain by looking at people who were in New York City on 9/11, putting them in a brain imaging scanner and having them recall events. And what we saw is that there's an interaction between the emotional part of the brain called the amygdala and the part next to it called the hippocampus, which is important for memory, and the two kind of structures talk to each other.
Right.
And they cause these emotional memories to be quite vivid. So I finished my PhD, and then I went to Harvard to do a short postdoc. And when I got there, I learned that what people were studying is how we imagine the future. So I was interested in whether the same brain mechanisms that are involved in how we remember the past, especially traumatic events from the past, are also involved in how we remember the future, specifically negative events in the future. So I started my first experiment where I asked people to imagine specific negative events that can happen in the future. For example, imagine the breakup of a relationship.
Right.
And what I found was that when I asked people to do that, they twisted and turned those events to make them positive. So if I told you, imagine the end of a relationship, what someone would say is, I broke up with my girlfriend, but then after a while, I found a better one. Mm-hmm. Or I said, imagine being stuck out of your apartment without the keys. And someone said, the landlady came over and she gave me the keys, and so I could get into my apartment. So basically what people were doing were kind of trying to find solutions to negative events to make them positive in the future. Sometimes they even made them really kind of extraordinarily positive, even neutral, kind of like mundane events. I would say, imagine getting a haircut in the future. And someone said, I imagine getting a haircut and I donated my hair to Locks of Love. And I went with my friends to a restaurant to celebrate. So I was quite angry about this because I wanted to study how the brain imagines negative events in the future, but they wouldn't imagine these negative events, so I couldn't do my experiment. And I tried asking different questions. And finally, I thought, well, this is quite interesting. It's not what I set out to study, but why is this happening? And so I did some research, and it turns out that in behavioral economics, there was quite a lot of research about this thing called the optimism bias, which is our tendency to imagine the future as better than the past, than the present. And that's exactly what I was seeing in this experiment. And that was really the first experiment that I did looking at what goes on inside the brain that causes us to have these kind of rose-colored glasses on when we think about the future.
So what are the implications of that for businesses, for instance, business leaders? You know, because I'm thinking particularly about security, because the environment in a security world tends to be, not always, but can be quite gloomy, particularly if we're looking at things like threats and that kind of thing. And I think some people, you know, listening to this may well be sort of smiling to themselves, thinking the notion of the optimistic CISO is not one that immediately comes to mind. So how could we sort of take what you're talking about and apply that into a sort of business environment?
Right. So, I mean, you're right that the first thing to think about is estimating risk. And what we find again and again is that people underestimate the risk.
Right.
And that's, of course, a problem. And it's not just underestimating risk. People also underestimate how long projects will take to complete, how much it would cost, right? Underestimating budgets. All these are related to this phenomena of the optimism bias. And so it's really difficult to try to convince people that their estimate is incorrect. Because what we found is that if you give people information to try to correct their estimate and they tell them, actually, you know, it's much worse than what you thought, your risk is much higher than what you're thinking, people don't take that information and change their belief to the extent that they should.
Right.
They do learn a little bit, but not enough. However, if you tell them, actually, you don't have as much risk as you think, you're in a great position, then they learn really quickly, right? That kind of positive, unexpected information, people take in really quickly. And when we do the experiments with the brain imaging scan, we can see that the brain really encodes this unexpected positive information about risk really, really well, more so than unexpected negative information about risk. So these are kind of the problems that are especially relevant to information security officers.
Yeah, and you know, I'm thinking about some of the security awareness programs that a lot of organizations run, and I'm not sure that they're actually coming at it from that perspective, which on the one hand, I suppose, perhaps is not surprising, but on the other hand, would help to explain why so many awareness programs fall short of that overall end goal. Would that be fair, do you think? Is that sort of thing that might be going on?
Yes, absolutely. And one thing that we can take away from our research is that it's helpful to reframe the message. So usually when we try to talk to people about risk, we highlight the negative events that can happen in the future. Mm-hmm. If you don't do this, if you don't take these actions, these negative events will happen, right? Security breaches and all of that.
Yeah.
But our studies show people don't take negative information about the future as well as they should. So you can reframe the message and say, well, if you do this, A, B, and C, then you will remain quite secure, right? Then you will save time, you will save money. So highlighting what needs to be done to get to the positive outcome, the goal. So instead of focusing on the potential negative outcome, actually reframing the message, it's the same content, it's the same message, but it is reframed to highlight what you need to do to get to the positive goal, which in fact is what a security officer wants, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
They want to get to this positive goal, which is you save money, you save time, you're in a safe position. But automatically our intuition is kind of to make the negative salient.
If you're interested in finding out more about the key factors that sustain good security behavior in the long term, download the ISF's briefing paper, Human-Centered Security, Positively Influencing Security Behavior. And get in touch directly with Steve at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn to become an ISF member today.
So are there any examples that you can give our listeners, for instance, of organizations that perhaps gone down that road and that you could compare the outcomes, the results from that approach versus what I would call a more traditional approach?
Yeah, so two that I can think of. One is insurance companies and the way that they talk to clients,
right?
And so there are like Prudential, for example, does this quite well in the US. So instead of trying to convince a client that, for example, if you don't buy insurance, if you don't get a retirement plan, then, you know, you will end up with no money and so on. What they do in their even advertisements that they have, they highlight if you do have a good retirement plan, if you do have insurance, then you will then have the time and money to go on holiday, right? So highlighting kind of the positive consequences of taking those actions.
Right. So some fairly big takeaways there for some of the awareness people who are probably listening to this in terms of how they might frame the positioning from a security standpoint, because clearly one of our biggest problems in security is the individual. If we look at the amount of breaches and the threats that manage to get through all of the defences, you know, a significant proportion are down to humans clicking on the wrong thing or not doing what they thought we were going to do. So some really interesting perspectives there, I think. Now, you've written two books, and in the second one, The Influential Mind, you isolate seven factors that are central to influence. Tell me about those.
Right. So one thing that I talk about is this relationship that we kind of touched upon just now between reward and action and punishment and inaction.
Right.
So not only are we more likely to take in information that is better than expected, it's also been shown that when you expect something positive, a reward, you're more likely to take action. Because we have evolved to associate actions with reward, right? If I'm thirsty, I need to move my hands and drink. That's my reward. So the brain is associating a reward with action. And so if you want to get people to do something, a lot of times highlighting a reward, and especially an immediate reward that they can get, is very helpful. The immediacy is quite important because we have what's called a present bias. We care more about the now than the future. Mm-hmm. In general, even if we're not aware of that. But often, to convince people to do things, we focus on the far future. Mm-hmm. So that's especially true for risks, right? Mm-hmm. But we need to try to think, okay, what will be the benefit for the now? If I take this action, then those good things in the future, but what is my benefit now? Mm-hmm. So try to think about how we can bridge, you know, the time from now to the future. And one thing, maybe my benefit now is reduced anxiety, right? Enhanced emotional state. So that's one thing. And then on the other hand, when I want to avoid something bad, I usually actually don't need to do anything on average. So for example, to avoid poison or deep waters or untrustworthy people, you usually need to stay away, mm-hmm. not do anything. Right? Mm-hmm. And so what the brain has evolved is to connect between a punishment and not action, inaction. And so our first reaction is to freeze. We can overcome that, but first we freeze, right? And so if you want someone not to do something, for example, not to share privileged information, then perhaps highlighting the potential punishment is a good idea. So you want to kind of pair rewards with action and punishment with inaction. Another thing that I talk about in the book is the huge impact of social influence. So we're social creatures. We care about what other people are doing. We want to do the same and we want to do it better. And what has been found again and again, that a simple, very cheap way to change people's behavior is to highlight the positive actions of others. So for example, the British government, in order to get people to pay taxes on time, they used to just send a letter and, you know, say it's really important to pay taxes, and this didn't work very well. So then they added one sentence, and that sentence said 9 out of 10 people in Britain pay their taxes on time.
Right.
And that sentence enhanced compliance by 15% and is thought to bring to the government about £5.6 billion. So this is just example. It works in many, many different domains as well.
So again, thinking about it from that sort of security perspective, really, I think trying to bring it home to people, what I'm hearing is make them sort of feel something along the way, some sort of emotional reaction as well, and to stress that they want to be part of the positive side of things rather than the negative. And what you're saying is that we will naturally lean that way, which again, I think, is probably different from what a lot of people would have imagined in terms of the way that they've gone about trying to influence in the past. So let's look at that again from the Chief Information Security Officer perspective and the challenge that they face today. Increasingly, we're seeing boards showing much more interest in security. Now, that's a good thing, but it also is putting a tremendous amount of stress and pressure on the CISO to be able to express the potential risk and really to position some of the things that they would like to do in a way that is perhaps outside of what they would normally do. So very often we will see a CISO bombarding a business leader, for instance, with data, which means absolutely nothing. So using some of the things you've been talking about, how could a CISO better position himself or herself with a board to get them on side and to hear some of the security messages that they need to get across in a more positive and therefore better perceived way?
So one thing that's helpful to do is to try to think, what is a state of mind and what are the beliefs of the person in front of you that you're trying to convince, right? So perhaps if they think these measurements are not helpful or not needed, it's important to know that. Mm-hmm. Because what we and many, many other people have found is that if you come in and someone already has a belief that's different from the one that you're trying to insert, they are less likely to take in the data and the figures and the information that you give them, right? If they think they come into the room and they already, you know, already made the decision in their head that mm-hmm. we're not going to go ahead with this, you know, this is not something that we want. If you then just give them data that contradicts that, what we find is that the person usually just shuts down. Right. And in fact, when we do some brain imaging studies on this, we see that literally the brain is just not encoding information that is contrary to what someone believes, right? Right. Kind of like we either like shut down, don't think about what you're telling me, or sometimes if you start telling me something that is contrary to what I believe, what I'm doing is I'm trying to come up with new reasons why I'm right and you're wrong, mm-hmm. right? And so what's helpful is to actually come in from an agreement position. Okay. What is it? Try to think, okay, so what is it that they do agree on, right? What beliefs do we have in common? What motives do we have in common? For example, highly likely that we both want our company to succeed. We have specific goals that we both want. And if we start from this common ground, the person in front of you will then see you as an agreeing partner mm-hmm. and more likely to then take in the data and information. So try to think, is there a way that we could get to where we want to go without actually focusing on what we disagree on?
Right.
Can we focus on what we agree on in order to get to the final position that we want to get to?
Now, all of that makes sense as we're talking about it, but I'm just thinking about some people listening to this, thinking to themselves, well, I'd love to be able to do that, but I haven't got a clue how to start because I come from a position that says, you know, it's about logic, it's about data. What are the sorts of things that they can do to try to shift some of that thinking, if you like, to try to position things better?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one thing that's also helpful is to give a concrete example. You know, you can call it an anecdote or a story, but it could be, you know, not just the data. Now, to be clear, data is very important for us to know what the truth is mm-hmm. and to make a decision. But on its own, it's not always the best way to convince someone to take a certain position, especially if they're leaning the other way, right? So we still need to have the data and we still want to have that. But on top of that, it's helpful to have perhaps an example. So for example, from, you know, another company, another CEO, an anecdote that really illustrates why the position that you're taking is the one that is best to take. And what stories do, they do a few things. First of all, we're more likely to attend to stories, right? To listen. They're more interesting. They're more colorful. They're more detailed. We're more likely to remember them, partially because they usually elicit more emotion mm-hmm. than just the data. So it's good to pair the two, to have the anecdote that kind of illustrates the data that you already have in hand.
Okay. So storytelling, what else could they do? Because again, I'm just thinking that some people who might think, well, I'd love to be able to do that, but I don't know how to do it. So what could people do who want to do a number of things you've been talking about, mm-hmm. but don't actually know how to get there? Is there some training they can attend or, you know, some, what can they do?
Oh, I see your question. I was thinking what they can do in terms of what principles they can use. In terms of training, I'm sure there are training. You know, there's also the books mm-hmm. And, you know, online videos and that kind of thing that could be helpful to do. Some companies have training tailored, right? So if, you know, within the company, this is something that a lot of people want training in, often a company will then go ahead and really tailor training for that specific group, which could be helpful.
So Tali, I think, you know, what you've done in the last 20 minutes or so is really highlight some quite different perspectives from the security standpoint anyway, some different thinking there in terms of how security professionals might want to go about looking at conveying some of these more difficult messages, using, as you say, story, referring to other organizations. Lots of really good hints and tips, I think, that you've covered there. And I'm assuming that you go into much more detail in your books around this as well, so people can take a look at those and go from there. So thank you very much for coming along and sharing those insights. As I say, it's a very different perspective, and I'm sure that our listeners will have taken a lot of value away from those things. And I would hope they'll go off and try some of them. So Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
If you found value in the conversation today between Tali Sherritt and Steve Durbin, please rate and review the podcast and share this episode. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. Don't miss the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, sharing conversations with members about the real-world applications of ISF research. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.